Good morning. Illinois went to court to stop President Trump from sending the state's National Guard to Chicago. We hear from the former head of the Illinois Guard on the risks of pitting citizens against the military. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether states can ban conversion therapy for minors. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Also, more than 20 years after the genocide in Darfur, The Hague has its first conviction. It's Tuesday, October 7th, the second anniversary of Hamas's attack against Israel and the beginning of Israel's war in Gaza. A third of Palestinians killed there are children. We'll have the story of one family who survived for almost 2 years of war and how those who remain must now cope with the loss of those who did not. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. This year's Nobel Prize for Physics has been awarded to three scientists, John Clark, Michel Divoire, and John Martinez. They're being honored for their discoveries in quantum mechanics, especially how quantum tunneling can be observed in many particles instead of only a few. The federal government shutdown has now reached day seven. NPR's Giles Snyder reports Democrats deny that talks are happening to bring the shutdown to an end.
President Trump seemed to open the door to a deal when he spoke with reporters at the White House.
We have a negotiation going on right now with the Democrats that could lead to very good things.
Democrats say they're ready to talk, but deny that negotiations are underway. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says the White House has been radio silent.
Neither Leader Schumer or myself have heard a word from the administration about resolving this issue, making clear to us that the White House wanted to shut the government down.
Democrats want to extend Affordable Care Act subsidies that make the cost of health insurance easier to bear. Republicans say the shutdown must end first. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that could invalidate state laws banning conversion therapy. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the practice is generally aimed at changing a person who is homosexual to a person who is heterosexual.
Conversion therapy, promoted by some conservative Christian groups, is banned for minors by half the states and staunchly opposed as harmful for minors by every major medical organization. But today, lawyers for a Colorado therapist will tell the justices that because she uses only talk therapy, banning the practice violates the Constitution's free speech guarantee.
NPR's Nina Totenberg reporting. Today is the second anniversary of the Hamas-led attack against Israel. Militants killed nearly 1,200 people and took 251 others hostage. NPR's Emily Fang reports one Israeli community is trying to rebuild.
Here in the kibbutz of Nir Oz, just miles from the border with Gaza, Hamas-led militants killed 47 people, a devastating blow for the tiny agricultural community. The new chairman of the kibbutz, Zvika Tesler, has been tasked with rebuilding. And he says there's tension among the kibbutz's residents over what to do with the burned and bullet-ridden husks of homes the Palestinian militants left behind. Some residents want to leave the ruins. Others want to live, he says, and demolish them. And even as Hamas and Israeli negotiators head to Egypt this week to hammer out details of a potential end to the war, for Nir Oz residents, where nine of their community members remain hostages in Gaza, they say the healing has yet to begin. Emily Fang, NPR News, Nir Oz.
This is NPR. President Trump has ordered the building of a road in a roadless area of Arctic Alaska. This would stretch for more than 200 miles. The road would permit new mining of minerals such as copper, cobalt, and others. This order is controversial. Local Alaskans who live off of the land say the building and mining will endanger fish and caribou migrations. The powerful oil cartel, OPEC Plus, has been producing more oil. This additional supply has helped push down global crude oil prices. NPR's Camilla Domonoske reports the extra oil has also played a big role in low and steady gas prices.
A group of oil exporting countries, including Saudi Arabia and Russia, are in the process of unwinding some voluntary production cuts. This past weekend, they had a virtual meeting and agreed on the 8th production increase in a row. Many analysts say the world doesn't need that oil. It's already on track for oversupply. When the price of oil comes down, it's good for U.S. drivers, who pay less for gasoline. But it's bad for U.S. oil producers, who can't produce oil as cheaply as Saudi Arabia can. So for Saudi Arabia and its allies, boosting production could be an opportunity to claim more market share. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
A maker of children's car seats is recalling certain versions of one model. Car seat maker Evenflow is recalling some of the Revolve 360 seats because of a choking hazard. The company says it got some reports of a few children picking foam out of the seat's headrest and putting it in their mouths. Evenflow is telling parents to visit its website. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
During times of economic recession, one of the first areas people try to cut costs is at the supermarket. That might be bad news for steak and lobster, but it's great news for a little thing called...
Spam for you and spam for me, we'll all live together in Spam.
That's right, Spam, a product that Hormel Corporation, based in Austin, Minnesota, likes to call meat with a pause button. Spam, which stands for spiced ham, was invented by Jay Hormel, son of the company's founder, during an earlier economic downturn, the Great Depression. One of Spam's most beloved qualities is the fact that it's cheap and has a long shelf life. Fans also seem to love its versatility.
What you got, Lynn? Well, there's egg and bacon, egg and Spam, egg, bacon and Spam, egg, bacon, sausage and Spam, Spam, egg, Spam, Spam, bacon and Spam.
That skit from Monty Python's Flying Circus is widely believed to be the origin of the more recent use of the word spam to describe excessive online posts or messages. The actual food spam is much more well-liked. In fact, it's eaten around the world and is especially popular in Hawaii, South Korea, and the UK.
Spam for you and spam for me, we'll all live together in Spam.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Texas Governor Greg Abbott gave an update on President Trump's plan to use the Texas National Guard last night. Governor Abbott tweeted a picture of troops boarding a military plane, deploying now, he wrote, although he did not give any details about where they were going.
President Trump has called on the Texas Guard to move into cities led by Democrats, including Portland, Oregon, and Chicago. The president asserts those cities are suffering from crime and that troops are needed to support his immigration crackdown. Elected officials in those cities see a political provocation on the streets.
NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has been following this, and she's with us now. Good morning, Jacqueline. So give us the latest in the legal battle over these troops that are supposedly heading to Chicago.
Illinois and Chicago filed a lawsuit yesterday morning in an attempt to stop the Trump administration from federalizing hundreds of National Guard troops, saying it's unnecessary and unlawful. But a federal judge declined to block the deployment of troops from inside the state, along with a force from Texas, for now. This all came a day after another federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deploying any National Guard troops into Portland, Oregon. At around the same time that the federal judge out of Chicago weighed in, President Trump was asked by a reporter under what circumstances he would use the Insurrection Act. That's the law that gives presidents the authority to deploy the military domestically. And here's what he said.
I'd do it if it was necessary. So far, it hasn't been necessary. But we have an Insurrection Act for a reason. If I had to enact it, I'd do that. If people were being killed and courts were holding us up, or governors or mayors were holding us up, sure, I'd do that.
So, Jacqueline, give us a little bit of a kind of a history lesson here. What kind of power does the president have to send troops into American cities?
The Insurrection Act gives the president authority to use federal troops to calm civil unrest in a crisis and to take part in law enforcement-like activities, which can include searches and arrests. But Trump has not used the Insurrection Act yet. Under normal circumstances, the National Guard is under a state command. That is, unless the president calls them into federal service. Here in the U.S., the National Guard has been used as a force to calm civil disturbances at the request of local officials. Retired Major General William Enyart led the Illinois National Guard from 2007 to 2012.
It's an appropriate use of the Guard to use them for civil disturbances, but these aren't civil disturbances. We're not talking about civil disturbances.
And so he's saying basically what Trump is doing now is not an appropriate use of that power.
Do we have any clarity as to why the president hasn't invoked the Insurrection Act?
Well, like we heard earlier, Trump says if he wanted to, he would. But the Insurrection Act has not been invoked since the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles more than 30 years ago. I asked Stephen Vladek, a law professor at Georgetown, about what he makes of that.
For better or for worse, I think the Insurrection Act has been a third rail politically for much of its history.
And instead of invoking the Insurrection Act, the White House is instead using an obscure provision of federal law to claim authority to bring in those National Guard troops. It's Section 12406 of Title 10, which I know is not very catchy. This law, enacted back in 1903, allows the president to call up the National Guard if there's a rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the federal government or if there's a danger of a foreign invasion.
As I think you've been telling us, using that law as the federal government's legal basis for sending in troops has gotten mixed results so far.
That's right. So in Portland, the judge wasn't convinced by the Trump administration's argument, but, you know, the administration is appealing that decision. Officials in Chicago tried to use the same legal argument. And as we discussed, the judge in that case decided not to block the National Guard deployment.
That was NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Jacqueline, thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Hayes is with us next. He's a former adjutant general of Illinois, which means he was the state's highest-ranking member of the National Guard. He led the Illinois Guard from 2015 to 2019. General Hayes, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I guess some of the longer-serving guard... You're doing fine, thanks. I guess some of the longer-serving guard members might have served under you. So how do you think about the troops who are being sent to Chicago, apparently?
Well, I would say this, you know, the troops raised the right hand and swore oath to the Constitution, in my case, in the state of Illinois, as well as the federal Constitution. They did so to serve their country. It's that simple. Also, I have no doubt that they'll go and do whatever legal missions put in front of them and do it to the best of their ability.
It's interesting that you stress the word legal. They'll do whatever legal mission is put in front of them. It is famously said the troops do not have to obey an illegal order. But in practical terms, if you're a soldier out in the field, or in this case, on the south side of Chicago, how do you know?
Well, the reality is everybody has their own views. I mean, you can't take that away or strip that from a soldier. But the allegiance to the Constitution is what drives everything a soldier would do. At all levels in the military, there's judge advocate generals that determine and assist commanders to determine the legalness of what they're about to do in front of them. All soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, space guardians, they have a duty to follow legal orders just as much as they have a duty to not follow illegal ones. So you're duty bound either direction. And so that is grounded in you since you really joined the military from basic training all the way through your career. And so they're going to drive everything they do against the criteria that would be appropriate between legal and illegal orders.
So your answer to that is that the commander on the ground will have a lawyer accessible to him or to her and might ask the question and respond accordingly.
Yeah, so one interesting thing, I think it's not well understood, is so Title 32 of the United States Code has been established to define the National Guard of the several states, and it's the rules by which the National Guard operates under the control of the governors. Correspondingly, Title 10, which was mentioned a few minutes ago, governs the active forces, and those rules and laws basically impart what can and can't be done. When the Guard gets activated by the governor, they conduct operations either in a state active duty status or under the Title 32 of the United States Code.
Okay.
But when the president federalizes the Guard, they revert and are put on Title 10 orders, just like if they were to go overseas and fight wars overseas on behalf of the nation. And in that, the governor and the adjutant general of the state cedes control of those troops to the active component. In the case here, what we're talking about is those troops are being activated, and they have been in California. We've seen that. The control of them went to U.S. Northern Command, which is the combatant command responsible for the defense of North America. Mm-hmm. So they're under the control of federal forces under the control of the president, not the governor or the adjutant general. And that's a unique distinction most people don't realize.
Well, when I think about the deployments in Southern California, the deployments in Washington, D.C., we have seen troops guarding federal facilities. We have seen troops backing up police in various ways, guarding safe areas of Washington, like around the Lincoln Memorial. We've seen troops picking up trash and trying to be helpful in various ways. Are those the sorts of things and only the sorts of things that would be legal to do in Chicago?
Well, so you asked kind of a nuanced question. I would say protection of any federal facility is a completely legal request. Protecting unarmed federal employees would be a reasonable request. Where it gets tricky and it's nuanced is any kind of link or support to law enforcement activities where you're part and parcel to them, even to the extent where you're maybe creating an outer cordon, that is an area that gets very tricky and it's nuanced. And so support to law enforcement of the Posse Comitatus Act is prohibited by military members, period. Now, if you're under state active duty working for a governor, your state code specifies what the Guard can and can't do. In the case of Illinois, I know it does. Illinois National Guard under state code can perform law enforcement duties, limited law enforcement duties. So
but
each state
has their own code. But under federal authority, they cannot perform law enforcement? Is that
where you're going? They cannot perform law enforcement unless the Insurrection Act is invoked by the president, and that has not been done so far.
Richard Hayes is a former adjutant general of the state of Illinois, the highest ranking member of the National Guard. General Hayes, thanks so much.
Yeah, have a great day. Thank you.
The IRS is getting a new boss. The Treasury Department says Frank Bisignano will take over day-to-day operations, but he's already got a day job running Social Security, and that's making advocates for taxpayers and retirees a little nervous. NPR's Scott Horsley has this report.
It's only been 5 months since Frank Bisignano was confirmed to run Social Security. He'd spent decades in the private sector, running financial and technology companies, and he told House lawmakers this summer he's determined to improve customer service.
Social Security must evolve to meet the needs of the 21st century. As commissioner, I am committed to significantly improving service quality and streamlining operations at the agency.
But now, Bisignano's been given another big hat to wear, running the IRS. The tax collection agency has churned through more than half a dozen leaders this year. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will keep the title of acting IRS commissioner, but he's given Bisignano the newly created title of CEO, along with responsibility for handling the nuts and bolts. The Treasury Department said in a statement that because the IRS and Social Security share many of the same goals for technology and customer service, Bisignano is a natural choice to oversee both. But Max Richman, president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, worries the Social Security boss will be stretched too thin.
He was not nominated and confirmed to be a part-time commissioner. He was confirmed for a full-time job.
It's not uncommon in the Trump administration for people to juggle multiple full-time jobs. Marco Rubio, for example, is Secretary of State, acting National Security Advisor, and acting Archivist to the United States. But Richman thinks putting one person in charge of both tax collection and Social Security is a mistake.
These are two monumentally important agencies, and now we're going to have one person essentially be in charge of running both of them.
Nina Olson, who is a longtime taxpayer advocate at the IRS, is also worried. Olson, who now heads the Center for Taxpayer Rights, wrote in an email, "This is unprecedented and does not bode well for a smooth 2026 filing season." Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
How's Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE? I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234 or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. 2 years ago, Israelis heard the sound of gunfire as militants came out of Gaza to attack. It's hard to take in how much has changed in those 2 years all through the Middle East, and we are hearing different perspectives throughout this day. Elsewhere this morning, a former Israeli hostage speaks. And right now, we hear the story of a family in Gaza. NPR's Zeya Batraoui is in Dubai, and NPR's Anas Baba is in Gaza.
Nidal Dalul describes the moment when he first became a father and laid eyes on his daughter. Dalul says it was dawn on Sunday, January 2nd, 2021, when the nurses brought her to him. She came after several rounds of IVF, 2 days of labor, and weighing 7.7 pounds. She was finally in his arms, white like milk, he says. He named her Noor, which means light in Arabic. The light, he says, of the heavens and earth.
Noor, samawat wal ard. Oh, Allah.
Dalul is in his mid-30s. He dropped out of school by third grade and earned a few hundred dollars a month working odd jobs as an adult. A typical life of poverty in Gaza. When he married his wife, they lived in a room in his parents' home in Gaza City. Noor's birth gave Dalul's life meaning and purpose, he says. He recalls whispering the Muslim call to prayer into her ear after she was born. She was a daddy's girl, showering him with kisses, helping him forget his troubles. Dalul says Noor stole his heart and became his world. In home videos like this, he films Noor with her straight black hair and wide eyes, dancing and singing, showered with the attention of the only child. When war broke out, Noor was just shy of 2 years old. In the months that followed, the family faced starvation in the north, displacement, and Dalul says he survived Israeli attacks trying to get flour off aid trucks. The family lived through 716 days of the war until September 22nd. That's when an Israeli airstrike targeted Noor's grandfather's home in an apartment block in Gaza City. And that's when NPR met Dalul. Here's NPR's reporter Anas Baba describing the encounter.
When I walked into the hospital, I saw all these bodies on the ground. It was an airstrike, and we rushed to the hospital. I saw a man between all of the people. He was laying on the ground of the hospital, cuddling his own daughter, I believe. She was covered in blood, flies all over her. The doctors, they told me that they were trying to convince him to let her go. And he refused for almost 3 hours.
He couldn't let her go. The airstrike killed Noor just 1 week before President Trump announced his plan for ending the war. NPR obtained video of the immediate aftermath of the attack. In it, Dalul is trying to reach his daughter from under the rubble. He and his wife scream out her name. They walk over rubble, under fallen concrete slabs, and into fires to reach the four-year-old. But this is the moment they find her, dead in the back of an ambulance. On the day she was killed, Noor was with her grandfather at his home in Gaza City. That afternoon, he was told by neighbors the Israeli army was about to bomb a building next to his. The military had ordered that building evacuated. But the building where Noor was also struck without warning. Noor's mother, Mirvat Hassanein, lists the family members she lost that day. Her father, her brother, his wife, their kids, her sister, and her daughter Noor. They were among 11 people the health ministry says were killed in that midday attack. Israel's military says it was targeting a Hamas facility, but did not specify if they were referring to the building with the clinic or the apartment block. The military told NPR that prior to the strike, precautionary measures were taken to mitigate harm to civilians. Noor is among approximately 20,000 children Gaza's health ministry says have been killed in Israeli bombings and gunfire in the last 2 years of war. UNICEF says an average of 28 children have been killed in Gaza every day, the equivalent, they say, of an entire classroom. An independent UN inquiry has determined Israel has committed genocide in Gaza, which Israel denies. But Hassanein says families like her brothers have been eradicated and that this is a genocide. Gaza's health ministry says 2,700 nuclear families have been killed in the war. Another 6,000 families have just one survivor. Without Noor, this family is hollowed. The couple now lives in a makeshift tent after finding their way south. She was buried in Gaza City. Her parents can't visit her grave because the only road north is blocked by Israeli forces. Dalul says the hardest feeling as a father is not being able to give your child food, money, or safety. They are like others in Gaza who may survive this war, but whose hearts have been buried. He can't find the words. It's indescribable, he says. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza City.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, how the war looks to Israelis. This is NPR News.
If you've watched Hulu's hit reality show, The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, you might think Macy Neely has it all, but her college years were anything but smooth.
I had just gotten home from college. I was pregnant and was kind of trying to figure out what to do with my life.
Macy Neely on her new memoir, Told You So, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. And coming up at 7:20, we'll get John Latimer's full phenology report. Sunny today with highs in the mid-50s, and tonight widespread frost is likely. And tomorrow, sunny highs in the low to mid-60s. It is National Fire Prevention Week now through October 11th, and the Minnesota DNR offers guidelines for wildfire prevention. Keep campfires small and manageable. Always have plenty of water nearby. Hold off on burning large debris piles until there is 3 inches of snow cover. And always check if a burning permit is needed at mndnr.gov/burning permit. If you see a wildfire, move to a safe location and call 911. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation announces the Itasca Area 100-plus Women Who Care Giving Circle on Monday, October 13th at Timberlake Lodge. Registration starts at 5 o'clock and program at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100, and nonprofits can be nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. And First Like Water, the visiting poet program at Central Lakes College welcomes Lee Young Lee this Wednesday at noon in the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Lee's poetry reading will be followed by a book signing and an informal talk at 1:30. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork this Thursday at 6:30. This month's film is Night of the Living Dead from 1968. Thanks for choosing KAXC this morning. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, October 7th, 1996, we had our first frost of the fall. If you define frost as the first day with temperatures below 32 degrees, then in the 108 years of record keeping here in the Grand Rapids area, 18 years have had frosts occurring in August, all before 1986, with the exception of 2004. 76 years had the first frost occurring in September, and 8 of those years, the frost occurred in October, with all occurring after 1988, with the exception of 1921. Historically, the average first date for frost is September 15th. Our 30-year average is September 22nd. The earliest frost ever occurred on August 11th, 1918, and the latest frost ever occurred on October 10th, 1997. Historically, our growing season has been 113 days, but if you look at just the last 30 years, we've had a growing season of 127 days.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Supreme Court justices will hear arguments today about the government's ability to regulate what is known as conversion therapy. It's a case that pits conservative Christian groups against major medical organizations and advocates for the LGBTQ community. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has this report.
Conversion therapy is generally defined as the treatment used to cure a person's attraction to the same sex, in other words, to make a gay person straight, and to cure a person's desire to change their gender identity by making them comfortable with their gender at birth. Every major medical organization, from the American Medical Association to the American Psychological Association, has repudiated the practice, finding that it doesn't work and instead leads to deep depression and suicidal thoughts in minors. As a result of these findings, half the states have banned the practice for those under the age of 18. Jessica Ritter is one of many former conversion therapy patients who now opposes the treatment. Raised in a devout Christian family, she says her first kiss was from another girl, and she was devastated when the relationship quickly ended, believing she would go to hell. So devastated that she eagerly embraced conversion therapy.
You're broken, and then you're doing all the things that they're telling you to do, and it's not working. It just broke me down.
It took her years to recover, she says. The Alliance Defending Freedom, however, cites other teens who, it says, have been saved by conversion therapy. The conservative Christian legal group is challenging the ban on conversion therapy, contending that it violates the therapist's right to free speech in talk therapy. The plaintiff in the case is Kaylee Childs, a licensed therapist in Colorado.
I want to be able to operate genuinely and create therapeutic relationships that are not hindered by the values and position of our state. And that's what my clients want as well. And currently, I'm having to turn them away.
Representing Childs, lawyer James Campbell will tell the Supreme Court today that what Childs does is purely talk therapy, and thus that it's protected by the Constitution's free speech guarantee.
The state can determine who is qualified to be a licensed counselor. It can determine that they have the right education, that they have sufficient experience. But what the states can't do is come in and say, you can have a conversation about a topic, but not if you're going to talk about it from this perspective. It's just blatant viewpoint discrimination.
Colorado Attorney General Philip Weiser counters that the state law is in fact narrow. It applies only to treatment of minors, and it allows anyone of any age to seek counseling from religious organizations without being subject to state licensing laws. But he notes states are entitled to require licensed therapists and other medical professionals to abide by the established standard of medical care.
What Colorado law doesn't allow is a discredited and harmful practice, which is now condemned by all the major medical associations. If you take away the ability of states to protect patients from substandard care, then you're opening the door to all sorts of discredited treatments.
Each side in this debate has to deal with an embarrassing fact. Briefs filed by those endorsing conversion therapy rely heavily on the CAS review, commissioned by the British National Health Service, which last year found insufficient evidence to justify transgender-affirming care for minors. But the CAS review reached a very different conclusion when it came to conversion therapy, condemning it as unsupported by science and not an approved treatment. As for Colorado's position, its opponents note that major medical associations have not always been right. Indeed, the American Psychiatric Association actually listed homosexuality as a mental disorder until 1973. Attorney General Weiser replies that medical science evolves over time.
There were times when we didn't know that smoking cigarettes caused cancer. But now that we know it does, it's wrong for a doctor to tell people to smoke cigarettes 3 packs a day and tell them don't worry about the health effects. That would be substandard care, just like conversion practices are substandard care.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The International Criminal Court has won its first conviction for genocide in Darfur. A former leader of a notorious militia has been found guilty at The Hague for his role in the atrocities in Sudan more than 20 years ago. NPR's Emmanuel Akinmotu has more.
Stand up, please, Ali Mohammed Ali Abd al-Rahman.
A judgment more than 20 years in the making.
For murder and attempt murder as a crime against humanity and a war crime, guilty.
Ali Mohammed Ali Abd al-Rahman was declared guilty of 27 charges.
For rape as a crime against humanity and a war crime, counts 8 and 9, guilty.
He stood in silence without reaction as he listened to the judgment through a headset, convicting him of crimes against humanity, mass murder, and sexual violence. He will be sentenced at a later date and faces life in prison at The Hague. Al-Rahman was a leader in the infamous Janjaweed, an Arab militia group used by the Sudanese government to brutally suppress a rebellion in Darfur. African ethnic groups who populate the region have long accused Sudan's government, which is dominated by Arabized ethnicities, of oppression. But 20 years ago, the suppression of the rebellion became some of the worst horrors in modern times, with hundreds of thousands killed and close to 3 million people displaced, according to the UN.
And today, we are very happy and pleased what the court did it.
Tajuddin Ismail is from Darfur and represents groups seeking justice for crimes committed there. He praised the conviction as part of a years-long quest to bring the perpetrators of the first Darfur genocide to justice.
We've been waiting for decades for this court, and this trial is sending the message for each one in Sudan, which is committing any crime, one day he will attend to the court.
Yet the praise is tempered by a bleak reality. Not only are virtually all of the main actors still at large, including Sudan's then president Omar al-Bashir, who was indicted by the ICC in 2009, but similar horrors and evidence of ethnic cleansing and genocide have exploded again in the region, committed now by the Janjaweed successor, the RSF, during a more than 2-year civil war in Sudan. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, people who defected from North Korea send money home. Remittances, as they're called. Brokers make those transactions possible, and we'll hear why both North Korea and South Korea are trying to shut down the brokers. You hear news of an unfree country in this free country on the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or on your community's local public radio station. This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. You're listening to the KAXE Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:45, we'll have student phenology talkbacks. Always great to hear from our listeners on what you're seeing in nature. You can text us 218-326-1234. Also, you can answer our question of the week. We want to know what libraries mean to you or have meant to you throughout your life. Text us 218-326-1234. Sunny today with highs in the mid-50s, and tonight clear skies and widespread frost. Temperatures dipping down into the low 30s, upper 20s, and for tomorrow, sunny highs in the low to mid-60s. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny with highs in the mid to upper 60s and breezy south winds. Happy Dancing Turtle is offering Family Nature Play Days, a chance for children ages 2 to 7 and their families to explore nature at the Hunt Utilities Resilient Living Campus in Pine River. Dates are Friday, October 10th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and Tuesday, October 14th from 3:30 to 5. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers Woodsy Walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. More news is next on KAXE.
KAXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Many Americans joined marches to protest Trump administration policies this year. Some of the people who did that wonder why there aren't more demonstrations, but also whether street protests are making any difference. Montana Public Radio's Austin Amestoy reports from Missoula.
At the end of a bridge that runs through the heart of the college town of Missoula, Montana, a ritual unfolds every Friday just after noon. About a dozen demonstrators hoist signs with messages of nonviolence, veterans for peace, peace on earth. Drivers honk in approval, and a passing cyclist rings a bell. This weekly gathering started 24 years ago. Carol Schneider, who's 82, was there just after the 9/11 attacks. She's returned nearly every Friday since.
Is it a protest?
I don't know.
Is it an action?
Yes.
Is it a statement?
Yes.
And we just, I don't want to give up.
This protest is happening just down the block from the Jeanette Rankin Peace Center, founded in 1986. Rankin, the first woman elected to Congress, is from Missoula, and she voted against U.S. involvement in World Wars I and II. Schneider has worked for most of her life to carry on Rankin's anti-war principles. But after 24 years passing out paper peace cranes on the corner, she says she sometimes worries their pleas are falling on deaf ears.
I struggle with hope. I struggle with what's going to be.
Schneider says it feels like no one's listening to each other, and the world is increasingly unkind. That makes it more difficult to stand on that corner. But she also says she's not going anywhere. Gloria Brown Marshall, who teaches at John Jay College, just published a book called A Protest History of the United States. She says protest in America
is healthier than it has been in the last 15 or so years.
Brown Marshall says the Black Lives Matter movement 5 years ago spurred a renewed belief that protest can make change. But she says modern movements often lack a key element.
My concern is what is missing in protest right now is the plan, the strategy.
Brown Marshall argues successful protest movements have been disruptive in some way to the economy, to travel, to peace of mind. Missoula's Jeanette Rankin Peace Center gave its Peacemaker of the Year award to someone younger last year, 37-year-old Brendan Work, a local school teacher. He says he admires the older generation that still takes to the street every Friday.
And I want to be like them. But maybe in previous generations, the terms peace, peacemaking, dialogue, listening, you know, these terms might have had closer to their original meanings.
Work founded Montanans for Palestine 2 years ago. In addition to marching in the street, its members pressure city councils to pass ceasefire resolutions, have disrupted a Democratic senator's events, and push Democratic voters to choose no preference over candidates that don't call for peace.
I think there's great error among Democratic strategists or people on the center left that leverage is a dirty word.
82-year-old Carol Schneider says she doesn't always understand the protest methods of younger generations. But on her street corner, she still manages to find hope every time she hands out one of her paper peace cranes to passersby.
And that little bit of conversation, just a little bit of flicker of some kind of thought that they may have, is worth everything for standing out there.
For NPR News, I'm Austin Amestoy in Missoula, Montana.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXE provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day,
I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Is no longer king for the first time in more than a century.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. First, the Trump administration has created a new job at the IRS. CEO Frank Bisignano will be taking on that position, in addition to his current job as head of the Social Security Administration. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
The job of IRS CEO did not exist before yesterday's announcement. For Frank Bisignano, the title will apparently mean overseeing, quote, all day-to-day IRS operations, according to a press release from the Treasury Department. And yet he technically won't be the IRS's leader. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will remain the IRS's acting commissioner, a role that's been held by seven different people this year. The last commissioner clashed with Bessent and was pushed out earlier this summer and has now been nominated to be the ambassador to Iceland. By making Bisignano the IRS's so-called CEO, the Trump administration might sidestep the Senate confirmation process required for the IRS commissioner. Bisignano has already received Senate confirmation for his other job, head of the Social Security Administration. In both positions, he'll be overseeing agencies that handle millions of Americans' personal data. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
It was the largest U.S. coal sale in more than 10 years. Yesterday, the government offered up the rights to lease federal land in southeastern Montana, and the highest bidder would get to mine 167 million tons of coal there. But the highest bidder was the only bidder, and they did not bid much. The Navajo Transitional Energy Co. offered just $186,000. That is about a tenth of a penny per ton of available coal. Back in 2012, a coal lease went for 1,000 times more. It is a sign of how far coal has fallen. For the first time, renewable energy is now the world's biggest source of electricity. It's a title coal held for more than 100 years. This is according to energy think tank Ember. Justin Rowlett is the BBC's climate editor.
Coal has been the main source for electricity generation literally since the dawn of the electric era. And so the fact that it's now been displaced by renewables really is significant. And that's why Ember, the think tank that published today's report, describes it as a turning point for the global energy system. What's really interesting is we've got the world moving at two different speeds. Lower income countries, led by China, becoming deeper and deeper into what it should be described as a solar revolution. And then developed countries moving much more slowly.
Justin Rowlett at the BBC. Meanwhile, the world's crude oil market is getting more glutish. OPEC Plus producers decided once again to expand output and drive down prices. That'll be tough for U.S. oil producers. Not so for oil consumers, though. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has that.
Even though a barrel of oil today is about $10 less than it was a year ago, Mark Finley with Rice University says
consumers don't consume crude oil. They consume gasoline.
And typically, lower crude prices do bring down gas prices, but
the national average for retail regular gasoline is $3.13 a gallon.
More or less the same as a year ago, Finley says, because of pressures on refiners. And analyst Tom Closa with Turner Mason and Company says, looking ahead,
gasoline prices will come off, but I don't think they're going to come off quite as aggressively. That's because of all of these drone impacts on Russian refiners. That's knocking out Russian refining.
He says even if lower crude prices continue,
I don't think it's necessarily going to be this wonderful dividend of deflation or disinflation for the public.
Especially, he says, because diesel and jet fuel prices are still pretty pricey. I'm Elizabeth Trovall from Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow futures down 0.2%. S&P futures down 0.1%. NASDAQ futures pretty much flat.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com.
Last month, the Fed decided to cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point. Tomorrow, we'll get a little bit of the inside scoop on how they decided to do that. We'll get the minutes of that meeting. Marketplace's Carla Javier looked into what they could tell us about what's ahead.
Former Fed economist Ann Owen was on her way to a class she teaches at Hamilton College about monetary policy.
I have a group of students doing a presentation about what the Fed should do at the next meeting.
And after that, they have some homework. Read and prepare to discuss the Fed minutes that come out tomorrow.
What are the issues that people who thought we need to lower rates more, what are they looking at? How are the people who think, well, one rate cut is going to be enough this year? What are the indicators that they're looking at?
One thing she's asked her students to look closely for, signs of disagreement. Owen says the minutes are usually pretty neutral.
But what you'll see is a discussion that might say some participants thought this was important, while other participants noted that.
Debate is healthy, says former Fed economist Claudia Somm. She's now at New Century Advisors.
At a moment like this, as complicated as monetary policy is, if everybody were in agreement, I would actually be worried that they're missing something. We should feel good about the fact that we have Fed officials really engaging with the data, really engaging with the tension that's in the economy, because that should lead to better monetary policy decisions in the end.
Somm says she'd be shocked if any discussion of the political debate about Fed independence makes it into the minutes.
By focusing on the data, focusing on the theory, focusing on how the Fed always does its work, that is their way of saying, hey, we're independent. We're still doing our work the way we would always do our work.
The minutes are also likely to contain clues about what could come next, says David Beckworth, a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
If you get a sense that the Fed's really concerned about inflation and some of them aren't as concerned about employment, that would tell you don't expect as many rate cuts going forward.
On the other hand, if more members are focused on unemployment, then more cuts could be in the cards. The minutes are not a full transcript of what transpired, though. That won't come out until 5 years from now. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. There's more ahead from Morning Edition, and then John Latimer and Heidi Holton, your host for the Tuesday morning show with student phonology talkbacks at 6:45 and John Latimer's latest observations at 7:20. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Sunny today with highs in the mid-50s, and tonight, widespread frost is